inexplicable look on his face. This isn't to imply that we dreaded the idea of actually going to Iraq. It was just a lot to take in. Traveling across the country, then the Atlantic Ocean, then into a war zone via Black Hawk helicopters, going to outer bases around Baghdad, etc., etc. It was all enough to give us whiplash, but we were in. We were actually going to go. This was an opportunity to finally put a face on the endless news cycles about Iraq and put it all in proper context. Uncle Sam. It was fun spreading the news. It's not every day you tell people that you're going into a war zone. A lot of friends and relatives were taken aback. Reactions starting with, "Oh my God," were common. But ultimately, regardless of their views on any given war, they were mostly happy to see the troops get a little sunshine. My mother was pretty casual about the whole thing. I asked if it concerned her that her little buoy was going to a war zone. Not really. That's Mom. She'll suffer quietly after I hang up. She wouldn't want to concern me with her concern. My brother Don never really gets excited. He's a mostly close-to-the-vest kind of guy, but when I told him Donovan and I were going to visit the troops, his glee was unabashed. "That is so cool," he practically shouted over the phone. In some way, I had just become legit in Don's eyes. He always felt that as an actor, I never experienced the reality of the world, and that being a soldier, now active 30 years, gave him a leg up in that department. Perhaps now I was becoming a person of substance. "Hey, see if you can get me some orders," Don asked out of the blue. "I'm military police. I have security clearance. I could be your escort over there." "Really? Come on, Don, it's the military. Wouldn't it cause a disturbance in the force?" "Hey, try it. I'll get you my info." The idea was too absurd not to pursue, so I passed the request through my agent Barry, along with Don's official info. "Sergeant, 1st Class, 75th Division, 3rd Brigade, stationed in Southfield, Michigan, been downrange 3 times. Currently intel with a top secret clearance, but also spent over 20 years as an MP. Life rolled along, and I engaged in the usual post-burn notice season ritual back in Oregon, fixed the place up, reconnect with local friends, hike, swim, take cool road trips, hang out and generally do as little as possible. That worked pretty well for a couple of weeks. Then Don shot me an email. His orders came through. "Holy crap, Don, you're in," I exclaimed. "Yep, I haven't told anyone until I actually got my orders. Now I'm good to go." Don made for the third stooge on this bizarre entertainment tour of duty. My orders arrived via email as well, official ones, from the Department of the Air Force headquarters. The funniest part was that it was technically an invite from the Secretary of Defense. Technically, we were distinguished visitors, DV Code 6. We were therefore ranked up there with 2-star general with regard to travel, accommodation, and security. That translated into being very safe and well looked after. It wouldn't be good military publicity to lose half the cast of the #1 rated show on cable. I joked with Jeffrey that if we didn't show up now, we'd be AWOL, absent without leave, and they would send Don to pick us up. There was no turning back now. The general elation of getting our orders faded a bit when it came time to slog through a sea of military paperwork. Lest we forget, Uncle Sam is the biggest bureaucracy in the world. Along with orders, we had to either sign or fill out a U.S. Air Force contract, bank transfer forms, provide a copy of our passport, bank routing numbers, federal ID numbers, and I'm sure they needed my mother's maiden name for some reason. Thankfully, the military is part of the 21st century, and almost all of it could be done electronically. It was time to gear up. There's a travel store in my local town of Ashland, Oregon, and I love to poke around in there searching for some new innovation that would make my life easier while trapped in a giant aluminum tube. Appropriate gear is nothing new to those of us in the film business. We work under any and all weather conditions when making films in different climates. This trip was cake in comparison. In Iraq, the weather was a downright chilly 85 degrees during the day. Positively L.A. It was enjoyable to engage in a semi-political discussion at a local outfitter store. I was in search of new wool socks for the journey, and I found myself explaining the upcoming trip. People become acutely interested in every minor detail of actors they recognize. But this fellow was more than curious. He was a bit put off that I would visit the troops if I was against the war. "It ain't about the war, pal. It's about the flesh," I argued. You want to support that mentality? He shot back. I want to support the schmoes who risk their lives. Needlessly? Yeah, whatever. Look, how much are the socks? Did I mention that Ashland, Oregon is a very liberal place? Neighboring Medford, a mere 14 miles away, is very conservative, and I find my world straddling the two. The reaction to my trip in Medford was completely different. Universally, I'd get a big smile and an immediate bone-crushing handshake. Viva la différence. In bidding adieu, Ida and I chatted about safety issues. She wasn't worried about my physical safety. She was worried I might see something that would break my heart. Fair enough, I thought, but it's not enough of a reason to stay home. Midwesterner meets Middle East. I try not to be a political guy, but what bugs me, bugs me. And wars are pretty high up on that list of infuriating human activities. War represents a failure of every other policy, a tragic loss of civility, a coup for barbarism. War is way too primal for me, too savage of a concept to wrap my head around. It's safe to say that I disagreed with the invasion of Iraq as opposed to the Gulf War from the get-go. I'll spare the world another actor's dissertation on achieving peace, but I do support the amazing idea that citizens are willing to take up arms and defend their country. It strikes me as a bizarre and mythical ritual. So aside from plain old curiosity, I wanted to give thanks to the young men and women who were willing to fight, not necessarily the old men who sent them there. From my small town of Medford, Oregon, Iraq wasn't exactly around the corner. My journey was as follows. November 9th, 2009, 10:05, Medford to San Francisco. San Fran to Washington Dulles Airport. D.C. to Kuwait. Kuwait to outlying U.S. military forward operating bases, FOBs, the beginning of an endless stream of military anachronisms. Destination, unknown. Jeffrey Donovan and I were going to travel on our own dime regardless, but we contacted the studio higher-ups to see if they felt like kicking in a support-the-troops kind of way. It was interesting to watch the various reactions of the USA Network, who aired Burn Notice, and Fox, who produced it. Given the fact that two of the three leading actors of their show were going into a war zone, the reaction wasn't great. In fact, we were asked not to go. There was technically nothing in our contract that prohibited us from visiting so-and-so country or doing such-and-such. We were on hiatus and could ultimately do what we wanted. That's why so many actors get in trouble during the hiatus of a given TV show. If they just kept working all the time, they wouldn't have time to do foolish things. It turned into a fingers-in-the-ears sort of thing, so Jeffrey and I made our own plans directly with the military. This tour was different anyway. Unlike a press junket where everyone kisses your ass up one side and down the other, this time around, we couldn't be picky. There was to be no, oh, I don't eat that, or sorry, my bed isn't comfortable crap. The word no would not be welcome. We were there to offer our thanks. This trip wasn't about us, and it was actually kind of liberating, not to mention humbling. I was oddly at peace as I boarded the plane for the first leg of the trip. The decades of international travel may have influenced my mood, as I have certainly flown farther to work. A 12-hour commute from Los Angeles and Auckland, New Zealand, during my Hercules and Xena days set the bar. But the idea of going into a war zone was a whole new ballgame. I was used to playing war, but to see it for real, that was the great unknown. I met up with Jeffrey in the Red Carpet Club in Washington, D.C. We both had the same reaction upon seeing each other. Yikes, we really are going. It hit me when I walked up to Gate 14. The schlumpy businessmen normally associated with air travel were now scruffy PSDs, personal security details, and unshaven middle-aged contractors spitting tobacco into styrofoam cups. We were not going into Kansas. Brother Don arrived at the gate, and by the time we exchanged hugs all around, it was time to board. My seatmate on the 12-hour flight to Kuwait was Hillary, who worked with the State Department. She was a fount of information regarding what we were about to encounter. Hillary specialized in infrastructure projects in small villages in Iraq and Afghanistan, ironically putting back together what the military takes apart, and both factions were well represented on the plane. Jeffrey was seated next to an ex-Blackwater security guard back from leave, so he got a 12-hour earful about the other side of the tracks. I'm not an airplane sleeper, so I got well into my Buster Keaton biography. Reading about a silent movie era comedian, seemed the perfect antidote for the current reality. Kuwait City from the air at night was pretty similar to most, a mix of ancient mercury vapor lights and the new halogen. Oil well burn-off, which seemed to be happening in all directions, resulted in a very science fiction movie effect in the atmosphere, and not the healthy kind. Touchdown was 6:15 p.m. There were no visuals to report. We left in the dark, and we arrived in the dark. I always get slightly claustrophobic when I can't see a new city skyline or geographical feature. We could have been anywhere. Visas were had for 3 dinars. The currency of choice in the TV shows Hercules and Xena were dinars, and my character Autolycus stole many sacks of them. But now I was using dinars for real in the place where it all began, a case of art imitating life meeting real life. On the other side of customs, which wasn't any more intimidating than usual, we met up with our team, security guys Dave and Dave, and our driver-slash-local-expert-slash-ex-military guy Brody. Our mode of transport was a perfectly cushy SUV. Brody explained that since a lot of SUVs are used to ferry brass and contractors around, much had been learned about which U.S. brands sucked in 130-degree heat and which ones did the trick. Brody was a big fan of the Chevy Tahoe. On the road, we assumed the formation. Our car was in the lead, and Dave stayed consistently 2 car lengths behind. They were certainly low-key in their dress and attitude, but they didn't dick around either. If Brody had to dodge around a bobbling Chevy Impala from the 70s, and I was astounded at the number of them on the road, the boys always kept right behind. As is the case in many foreign countries, driving in Kuwait is all over the map. We were passed on both sides by every kind of SUV, luxury, and sports car available, some driven by women. Kuwait is a tad more relaxed in that department. It was a stark reminder that something considered unique in this region, like allowing women to drive, is so mundane back home. Thanks for stopping by. Our destination was the sprawling Camp Arifjan. Used as a forward logistics base, or FLB, anything that comes and goes to the Southwest Asian Theater passes through this crazy big place. Word on the street was that the Kuwaitis covered the cost of Arifjan and still supply all the oil/gas needed to operate it, free of charge. I guess you could say it's a holdover gift to us for stepping in during the first Gulf War. Kuwait has a lot of oil and would like very much to keep it. With them sitting on top of 104 billion barrels of proven reserves, with oil accounting for 90% of their yearly revenue, you can understand their edginess that Saddam Hussein, their aggressive neighbor to the north, was going to march in and grab it. Their intuitions proved correct, so much so that this rich country was hesitant to flaunt its wealth for fear that something as grand as a palace was an easy target. Brody, who makes his home in Kuwait, explained that all the new construction was unique and that now they weren't afraid to strut their stuff a little. It was also significant that Arifjan was permanent, with multi-story administrative buildings, living quarters for 9,000, 3 buffet-style mess halls serving 4 meals a day, and 4 base exchanges, as in stores, that would dwarf your local Walgreens. Recreationally, a massive weight room, an outdoor pool, and a full-size basketball court were available, some 24 hours a day. Not that it was necessarily good for them, but apart from the base chow, the modern-day soldier had access to an astounding array, 15 to be exact, of brand-name fast-food outlets. The basic plan was to crash for the night in our dorm-like rooms, Building 162, to get to know the base a little better and do some signings the next day. Because my sense of time was whacked, I was up at 5:30 in the morning doing email and changing my return flight. The base really did make it seem like you were just in a different state, albeit a hot, dusty one, rather than a different country. I guess that was the idea. Most everything is planned in the military, so grub was in order at 7:15 a.m. Chow was at the Oasis, a bright, super clean facility where we dined on made-to-order omelets. I know that many soldiers have it rough, but not here. We did a walk around after breakfast, trying to take in the scope of the base. It started to dawn on us what it takes to stage a military operation. I swear to God, half the soldiers we met at our 11:30 signing were in some form of logistics. It makes a hell of a lot of sense when you have hundreds of tons of gear and thousands of humans coming and going from sea, land, and air. A pattern soon developed at signings. Soldiers stepping up to our table would invariably blurt, "Hey, where's the chick?" "We were okay," was the insinuation, but Gabrielle Anwar would have been way better. This became such a regular refrain from soldiers that Donovan eventually insisted that I give him a dollar every time a soldier made that reference. I'm not sure exactly why I agreed to the payout. It was really a losing bet, and you never want to bet with Donovan. He's a wicked gambler who actually understands what he's doing at casinos. To combat an ever-dwindling pile of single-dollar bills, I therefore insisted that he fork over a dollar every time a soldier came up to the table with, "Hey Ash, where's your chainsaw?" The Evil Dead films are very popular with the armed forces. I knew that from meeting servicemen and women at civilian signings over the years, and it turned out to be the perfect antidote to this stupid bet. For the next week, Donovan and I silently exchanged dollar bills whenever the appropriate reference came up. Soldiers wondered what the hell was happening, but it amused us to no end. The afternoon was free, and we readily accepted an invitation to drive an Abrams tank. It wasn't an offer you get every day, and it wasn't something Donovan, a motor sports guy, and my crazy brother Don were going to pass up. Hey, what the USA Network didn't know wouldn't hurt him. Donovan was up first. The controls of an Abrams tank are kind of like a motorcycle, but the grips are much closer together. You steered and revved with the same controls. Donovan was off like a shot around the dusty oval track, and he tore the place up, taking turns that made even the tank guys shudder. A quick reminder, the Abrams tank is powered by a gas turbine engine. It's a freaking jet turned sideways, and it sounds like one. After three or four laps, I was up next. As I maneuvered all 62 metric tons of this beast onto the track, I gunned it. Nothing happened. You want to give it some gas there, sir, the commander urged me from his perch in the turret. I'm gassing, I said, twisting the throttle toward me as much as possible. Then, poof, dark smoke billowed from the back of the tank. I'm not a mechanic, but I knew that wasn't a great thing. We should go ahead and hop out, the commander said calmly, but he wasted no time putting distance between himself and what was soon to become a fire. Brother Don and Donovan reacted with glee. Way to break the tank, Don said, smiling. It's only 6 million and change. In about 5 minutes, a fire truck showed up with an assortment of men on ATVs, fire rescue equipment at the ready. Thanks for giving us something to do today, one soldier offered as he drove past. Arif John was also a RAD, Repair Activity Depot, so they had what they needed to repair just about anything. Minutes later, another fire truck arrived, and a group of men stood around watching a couple guys do the actual work. Just like home, I thought. Eventually, a giant vehicle arrived to tow the disabled war machine away. If you've ever wondered what kind of machine is needed to tow an Abrams tank, the answer is a really big one. This was just a glitch in the road to our gracious host, and they simply brought over a different piece of equipment to drive around. This time, an M2 Bradley IFV. Infantry Fighting Vehicle, which was also a troop carrier and a tank killer. Don was all over this thing like a cheap suit, and he cut a pretty macho rug over a large dirt training area. Driving a Bradley was kind of like driving a giant go-kart. The controls were primitive with an oversized gas pedal. As with driving anything large, nothing could be done, quote, on a dime. You always had to give extra room and time to any maneuver. If you have claustrophobia, tanks are not for you. If you're heavier than about 200 pounds or taller than 6 feet, give up your dreams of staging epic battles in the desert. Manning a tank is a job for short, wiry guys who don't have an issue with baking in their own little Kuwaiti desert oven. Luckily for us, the temperature was a chilly 83 degrees. Cliff, the tank guy, ran us through our paces. Cliff was a throwback from another war. But this wasn't a Vietnam or even a World War II throwback. This guy was positively World War I. He had a pinch between his cheek and gum, but he may as well have chomped on cigars. His teeth were yellow, veering into brown because he chewed tobacco. And like most scary people you meet, there was a coldness in his eyes. He had a warm smile, but it evaporated quickly, depending on the subject at hand. Cliff's current goal was to get to Afghanistan. Well, why would you want to go there? I asked. That's where the action is. They won't let you do nothing in Iraq anymore. We're just babysitting here. But isn't the idea for the soldier to get his ass back home as soon as possible? Cliff shrugged. I got everything I need here. Everything? I asked, pushing him a little. I thought this was a dry kingdom. Cliff looked at me without blinking or smiling, but his voice reeked with sarcasm. Yeah, okay. Sure it is. When pressed about his personal life, he explained that his last leave was mostly wasted finishing up a messy divorce from his second wife. Tell you what, I'm done with that shit, he said, shaking his head slightly, letting a brown streak of goo dribble out. Ain't worth the aggravation. That shit, I assumed, meant dating or wives or women in general. Sometimes war makes a lot more sense, Cliff said, scanning the horizon. I can fix a tank in my sleep, but I can't fix a damn woman. I could have talked with a guy like Cliff all day. He was a zero BSer who also acknowledged as a soldier that not all of it was good. I done some bad things, he confessed, but I seen some bad shit they done, and it was way worse. A rigid military schedule pulled me away from Sergeant Rock, and we were off to a different part of the base and another signing. En route, we saw remnants of the Gulf War. A series of concrete bunkers had been destroyed by what was clearly precision bombing. And who was going to clean that crap up? In an interesting twist, the bunkers weren't destroyed by Saddam. They were destroyed by the United States once Saddam took the airfield over. This caused an uncomfortable situation as the bunkers, built by the French, were supposed to be bomb-proof. The French position in the dispute was simple. We did not say the bunkers would withstand American bombs. Signings for military folks half a world away always came with their own curiosities. Although we traveled with our own mini-poster to sign, this was, after all, the information age, and these people had access to the Internet. This produced freshly printed obscure photos of my past or present and some very interesting DVDs. Some bases allowed third-country nationals to sell wares to the soldiers at small bazaars or, quote, haji shops, as they were known on base. For starters, most of these DVDs were bootlegs, and in places such as Kuwait and Iraq, the cover art has to pass a different set of codes. Showing bare skin is a bozo no-no in this culture, so it was very amusing to compare the cover of a legitimate Burn Notice DVD brought from home and the Photoshop cover of a bootleg where Gabrielle Anwar now mysteriously wore leggings and long sleeves. With a couple clicks, she went from Hollywood to Bollywood. Either way, I was just glad the Burn Notice was popular enough in Kuwait to drive such a need, albeit under the table. While waiting for our ride, a C-17 Globemaster III, we took in a concert by Hip Kitty, a really fun band that did upbeat, familiar music. With music still ringing in our ears, we loaded our gear onto the massive C-17. With just 5 civilians and a couple white SUVs in the hold, we were comfortably shy of their 170,000-pound payload limit. There was room for Donovan and me in the cockpit, and we jumped at the chance. I was continually astounded at how young the soldiers were, or airmen in this case. The 3-man team seemed barely out of college, but this was no frat house. They were focused, cool-headed, and generally pretty cheery. It was a kick to listen in on the chatter, which may as well have been a different language, as these guys methodically checked and cross-checked in preparation to get this hog up in the air. The Glass Palace. Along the route, which is only an hour by car from Kuwait City to the border, we were invited to check out a local oddity, courtesy of night vision goggles. As I scanned the desert below, the goggles revealed about 2 dozen flickering lights with a pronounced haze around them. That's eerie looking, I said to the pilot. What the hell is it? Those are the oil fires that Saddam lit on fire. The ones back in 91, I asked, incredulous. I thought they were put out. Not all of them, the pilot said casually. I guess the Kuwaitis figure it's not worth it. Well, that's disturbing, I said, handing the goggles to Donovan. Around 11 p.m., we touched down at the Glass Palace, Saddam's personal airfield in its heyday. On the ground, we got acquainted with our new guides, J.J., an ex-military guy who spent some time at Disney Studios, and his soon-to-be replacement, Judd. It was dark again, so there wasn't much to see on the way in, but we were again going to another sprawling complex, Camp Victory. In the morning, wandering outside before 7:30 chow, I took in the layout. When Saddam ran the show, this area was a series of palaces. He had 60-some around Iraq. In order to hunt and fish at will, Saddam dredged a massive lake and built a series of palaces, large and small, around it. The lake is stocked with enormous, quote, Saddam bass, which aren't even bass. They're a species of asp fish that grows upwards of 6 feet and weighs over 100 pounds. When coalition troops rolled into this area, a number of soldiers were assigned to round up the odd assortment of wild animals that were roaming free. Sharpshooter Saddam couldn't get enough of randomly gunning down exotic animals on his back 40. The base provided plenty of incongruity. Roadways named Missouri Street, leading to an Iraq despot's vacation palace. On the base, when soldiers didn't have to wear uniforms, they wore black shorts, a gray t-shirt, and an M4 slung over their shoulders. Kind of like a crossing guard with an attitude. Our hotel rooms at Camp Victory were in one of Saddam's smaller palaces, but small would not be the way you'd describe my suite. The ceiling was easily 20 feet high, and pretty much everything was covered in a marble veneer. These rooms, used mostly for military personnel now, have gone from not-so-shabby chic to upscale multi-purpose. Don's room had bunk beds, and mine had an 8-seat conference table. Hey, if you're going to have a boring logistics meeting, it might as well be in some ornate hall. But looks weren't everything. You didn't want to drink the tap water in our palace under any circumstances. Cases of bottled water in the bathroom told the whole story. My shower was positively Green Acres. The hot water was a long time coming, and when it arrived, you never knew how long it was going to last. Either way, it was odd to take a military shower in a dictator's palace. Odd fobs. The plan for the next 3 days was to base out of this camp and visit a series of fobs of varying size. Troops were informed about our arrival, and it was all pretty casual. We'd find a folding table, set up a couple chairs, take pictures and sign stuff that we brought with us, Sharpies included. We didn't want the troops to think about anything. On our list were bases, and I'll do my best here, Nasir Wasalam, Akir Kuf, Sheikh Amir, COS Mead, Mahumandiaya, JSF, Jisufakaya, none of them even close to Wichita, Kansas. Departure the next morning, via Black Hawk helicopter, was at 0800 from a small but very busy airfield. It was really just a place for choppers to come and go, as there is no actual landing strip. This field was populated by an interesting cross-section of folks involved in the war effort. National Guardsmen. You could tell those guys by the 20 extra pounds they carried around on average. Contractors, older, not in uniform. Special forces, young, bearded, also not in uniform. And diplomats, looking as out of place at the airfield as we did. Waiting for our ride, Donovan and I made our way up to the control tower to sign a few things for guys who couldn't leave their post, and we got a great overview of the field. A large hill in the distance had every imaginable kind of radio or cell tower on it. "That's an odd-looking hill in the middle of nowhere," I mentioned to a young controller. "Yeah," he agreed. "That's where they put the dirt from Saddam's lake. Now it's the best place for towers." Our tandem Blackhawks landed right around 0800. They travel in pairs as an official policy now since the very ugly Black Hawk Down incident happened in Mogadishu years before. Armed with what seemed like vintage flak jackets and helmets, we were ready to roll. The UH-60 Blackhawks are amazing to watch in action. They're both fast and powerful and armed with dual 50 caliber machine guns. We wanted to watch one land in front of us, but after the first wave of dust and rocks hits you in the teeth, it dawns on you why everyone turns away from a helicopter landing. We raced to the chopper and ducked inside. These were open models, no glass in the windows. We were flapping in the wind. The two gunners who helped us buckle into fabric seats were all business. There wasn't any small talk. After a few of these rides, a pattern emerged. If the pilot knew who we were, the gunners would hand us headsets as we boarded. We'd chat up the captain or co-pilot along the way. If they didn't, we just kept our helmets on. As we rapidly ascended, the gunners snapped up the barrels of their guns and swept the horizon for bogeys. Down below, we got a better sense of geography and landscape. Because two major rivers converge around Baghdad, the place is remarkably irrigated, and it would have been a good double for Phoenix, Arizona, or San Bernardino, California. Each of our chopper rides was 10 minutes or under, as these bases were mostly on the outskirts of Baghdad. Our first landing was Nasir Wa Salam, a striker division. The captain who ran the base was a really cool guy, reserved, tough, and smart. We found out later he got a Silver Star in a tank battle a few years before. He was the old man now, but it was clear that his guys respected the hell out of him. Most commanders started us off with a tour, which always gave us a quick idea of the size and focus of the base. The perimeter was essentially concrete blast walls 15 feet high. The grounds were covered with 4 inches of river rock, so there was a maddening step forward, slide half a step back sort of thing going on. I was assured that this was far preferable to the moon dust on the desert floor, which permeated clothing, equipment, and every personal nook and cranny. The rock itself was from the Euphrates River and implemented by Iraqi engineers. Each base had a way to keep an eye on itself, literally. A tall tower at the edge of the compound provided radio and cell communications, but also hosted a high-powered video camera that could zoom in to amazing detail night or day. The young soldiers manning the cameras looked very much at home with their joystick-slash-video-game-style controllers. At JSS Yusufaya, we were asked to participate in a reenlistment ceremony. One of the recruits was re-upping, and the base commander was making a big deal of it in the mess hall where all the soldiers were congregated. The ceremony was very sincere and straightforward. The soldier in question received a patch on his shoulder, something to add to the other patches. This was a very Boy Scout approach, where you hold ceremonies to laud the accomplishments of young men. These patches are so prolific that soldiers now have Velcro on their sleeves to more easily rearrange or change their layout. As visiting dignitaries, we started to build our own collection of swag. Not only patches, but coins, too. I wasn't hip to the whole coin thing when it first happened to me, and I bungled it right off the bat. The idea was that a base commander or higher up reaches his hand out to shake yours, usually accompanied by a thank you for your support of the troops type of thing, and then he surreptitiously transfers a commemorative coin into your hand. When it first happened to me, when my hand touched a strange, cold object, I impulsively yanked my hand away, thinking it was a joy buzzer, and launched the sacred coin into the air. Every war-hardened soldier in the room winced at the gaffe, and you can bet your bottom dollar that I never dropped another coin. The trick upon shaking is to turn the officer's hand horizontal and let the coin simply drop into your hand. Yeah, sure, I know that now. Food on these forward bases was all over the map, quality-wise. Wazir Wa Salam had easily the worst food I've ever eaten, certainly top five. It was a buffet layout of brown, deep-fried food. Some visiting soldiers knew better and went straight for the meal replacement drinks instead. A smaller base we visited a few days later was 10 times better because their food wasn't provided by outside contractors. They had their own cook. There we dined on prime rib, mashed potatoes, and green beans. Each base did what it could to create a sense of normalcy. The smallest base, Akur Kuf, kept 3 dogs. One of them was white but was so covered in dust they called it Dirt Bag. Another pooch, who slept all day, was aptly named Duty. The third dog, Courage, ran away any time you tried to pet it. The familiar sight of these friendly canines really did have a positive impact. It made your mind jump out of a concrete and river rock encampment in a generally hostile foreign country to a sleepy fishing hole in rural Georgia, where you and your mutt Blue are angling for catfish on a lazy summer afternoon. In a war zone, there are a lot of fully automatic weapons. FOBs were no exception. These men and women were armed to the teeth. Donovan, Don, and I were invited numerous times to, quote, pump a few rounds, and we never turned them down. Shooting live ammo isn't that much different from shooting blanks on a film set. Both are extremely loud. The difference is that when firing fake bullets, you don't inhale a steady stream of gunpowder residue, and you never see the effects of your weaponry, like the side of a dirt hill being shredded in front of you. Each FOB had a history. Some of them were chosen for strategic placement. There were dozens around Baghdad alone, and others were selected because the owners of the land were willing to cooperate. One base had previously been a farm, but with several tall structures and a two-story farmhouse, the place was ideal for a base. The Pakistani farmer agreed to a $70,000 a year deal and only stopped by a few times a year to get paid and check on the place. Greeting soldiers on duty posed slightly different problems because sometimes you had to figure out how to get to them. The young recruits on lookout duty at this former farm were stationed at the top of a concrete grain silo. To reach them, we had to make our way up a jury-rigged series of wooden ladders and platforms, not unlike a tree fort. Our visit to Sheikh Amir culminated in a pickup game of basketball. I can't personally recommend this activity, at least not for an out-of-shape middle-aged guy playing against war-hardened 20-something studs in the desert. It was a fast track to humiliation. When a soldier yelled, "Come on, Ash, suck it up!" it was the one time I couldn't tell him to shove it up his ass, mostly because I didn't have enough wind to speak. It was always fun rounding out our FOB visits with a trip to the communications area, where scores of soldiers on these remote bases could Skype live with family members or shoot off an email on a daily basis. God bless technology. This type of direct communication has got to be better for the families and troops than during the Vietnam War, as an example, when soldiers still relied on excruciatingly slow snail mail. Jeffrey and I enjoyed interrupting sometimes romantic calls between a soldier and his significant other on the other end of the line. These remote wives or girlfriends were often wearing very relaxed clothing, and some of them weren't wearing much at all. The morning after our 6 FOB visits, I woke feeling like hammered dog shit. I felt extremely hungover, and there wasn't an ounce of alcohol involved. I assumed that this was a combination of shockingly bad air quality, dust inhalation, stress, and the fact that a thunderstorm in the middle of the night sounded like we were under direct attack. Jeffrey felt like crap, too, while Don, Mr. War-Torn, chuckled at our state. "It's a war zone, guys. It's natural to feel like shit." Command and conquer. Our next stop after mingling with the troops was to visit the administrative/support side of the war, which was a huge part of the equation. In our random sampling of troops at signings, we were amazed that about 2/3 of the troops we polled were not actively in combat. Their support came in the form of transportation, communication, information technology, logistics, medical, and engineering. It's the lopsided nature of modern conflict. The roots of the warfare tree run deep and broad. I finally got to see from my own eyes that big-budget action movies aren't all full of shit. Giant command centers and auditoriums the size of a top-10 college lecture hall boasting easily 200 HD monitors do exist. The setup provided Operation Iraqi Freedom with its eyes and ears. In addition to the myriad of small screens, averaging 5 to a person at smaller stations, a screen worthy of a high-end movie theater anchored the room, where desired images could be magnified for all to see in incredible detail. This made me recall the white blimps we saw floating above the city of Baghdad. Initially, I thought it was odd that they were not moving around or advertising anything, until I was informed that those blimps were wired with digital cameras and audio sensors. From their multiple fixed positions around the city, the blimps could triangulate the location of, say, a random gun shop. Scary cool. I've always found it amusing that invading or conquering troops always base out of the former headquarters of their opponents as a way of saying fuck you to the vanquished. I guess that's why German and American troops alternated use of the finest European chateaus and castles during World War II. The notable thing about Saddam's palaces was the smoke and mirrors aspect. They looked impressive as hell from a distance, but upon closer inspection, most of them would be condemned for shoddy construction. A sweeping second-story balcony overlooking the lake Saddam constructed was breathtaking until you inspected the many elaborate columns which were crumbling and packed with dirt. There was no solid granite or marble anywhere. Even the world's largest chandelier hanging in the grand entrance hall was made out of plastic, not crystal. I couldn't help likening Saddam's palaces to Las Vegas casinos. That was most of the topic of conversation when we dropped in to meet the military brass, in this case, 2-star General Joe Anderson. General Anderson was very gracious as he welcomed us into his expansive office, which was part of a huge administrative complex based out of Saddam Hussein's largest, most impressive hunting palace. I'd been in the world of make-believe as long as General Anderson had been in the ultra-real world of waging war. So I wouldn't say we shared the tons in common award. Mostly, Donovan and I marveled at the size and scope of the operations General Anderson and his troops had to put into place and how impressed we were with the quality of the personnel along the way. In turn, while General Anderson most likely will never see Evil Dead 2, he certainly appreciated that actors help entertain and or distract his soldiers when they're not on the battlefield, bringing a little cheer into their overstressed lives. The next morning, our last in the war zone, I sat down outside the palace and jotted some Baghdad musings. Hard to believe I'm in a war zone. Sunrise over Saddam's palace is, dare I say, bucolic. Cool breeze, lovely cloud patterns, all the more deceptive. In reality, after only 4 days in this city, I'm very ready to leave. I believe I'll be kissing the ground upon return. The air sucks and there's a faint gloom slathered all over everything. The soldiers seem as well-adjusted as possible, but happy is not a word to describe their mood. Wars blow. The idea of a good war or a just war sounds great in speeches and on talk radio. But it halts the march of civilization, kills and maims humans and disrupts families, not to mention the god-awful cost. It really hit me that if you're going to go to all this much effort and expenditure, it had better be for a damn good reason. Returning home. The return plan included a stop at the fabled war hospital Walter Reed, now defunct, in Washington, D.C. to visit the wounded. It didn't seem like our troop visit would be complete unless we stopped in on the folks who really sacrificed. Approaching the physical therapy gym, Donovan and I exchanged a wary glance. What was this going to be like? What would we say to these kids that would have any positive impact whatsoever? We decided that these kids were tough and that we shouldn't tiptoe around what had happened. If the guy was missing his legs, there must be a story behind it, and we wanted him to talk freely about it. Most of the fresh patients were soldiers from Afghanistan. The casualties were from roadside bombs, the dreaded IED, or RPG, rocket-propelled grenade. The damage to their physical bodies ran the gamut from mild to grotesque, but you couldn't look away. The first soldier I met told the story of how he lost his right arm. RPG tore the thing right off, he said matter-of-factly. So it blew up nearby, I asked ignorantly. No, man, the rocket itself did this, just the force alone. I'm not sure where the hell it blew up. Behind me, a gravelly voice called out, Hey, Ash. I turned to see a soldier holding up the stump of his arm. I could use that chainsaw right about now, he said ruefully. I couldn't help but smile at the Evil Dead reference, but there was nothing funny about his wounds. You could see from his injuries where a bomb had impacted the entire left side of his body. His left eye was glass, which he cheerfully popped out to show me. His left arm was half gone, and his leg was a nightmare of reconstructive titanium pins. So, do you at least have some good days? I asked, tentatively. Oh, hell yeah, he said with a smile. I got drunk and laid this past weekend, so I'm good. Another soldier who was also missing a leg explained that everything was fine with his girlfriend, even though his leg was mangled badly, as long as he still had it. The doctors had explained that all of his complications would end if they just removed the leg. In excruciating pain, he reluctantly agreed. The good news, his complications ended. The bad news, so did his relationship, because his girlfriend couldn't handle the new reality. One young kid, maybe 18, was fresh from an Afghanistan battlefield, sprawled out in bed, tubes connecting him to half a dozen machines. This kid literally didn't know what hit him. Where were you when it went down? I asked. I don't know, he said after some hesitation. What happened to you? I don't know. The soldier began to tear up, attempting to reconstruct the recent events, and his young mother gave us a nod like, it's time, and we moved along. One of the striking things about meeting these young soldiers was that their number one concern and driving motivation was to return to their unit and resume active combat. A legless soldier was utterly convinced that he could rejoin his unit before it came home in a couple of months. Like all wars, casualties are unpredictable, and the ripple effect is wide. We visited a female reporter who was embedded with troops when her striker vehicle hit a roadside bomb. "Fucking death traps," she scowled, looking down at her badly shattered leg. In order to get the care the reporter needed, her schoolteacher's sister had to take a leave of absence and travel from another state to help out. The saddest case Donovan and I encountered that day was the soldier who refused to see us. Every other soldier, no matter how bad off, seemed surprised and pleased to see us, but this soldier had been shot through the face and was in no mood for glad-handing. Not everything works out all neat and scripted. Not even the warm and fuzzy visit the troops part. Jeffrey and I left the hospital humbled and quiet. In our line of work, nobody is really in danger. Our food service and workplace accommodations are off the charts in comparison to the average military grunt, and they're the ones getting shot at. It's safe to say that neither of us will complain about hot summers in Miami ever again. Chapter 16, Legends of the Fall. When a TV series approaches its third season, entertainment lawyers and studio accountants brace themselves for a showdown. The speculative freshman first season is over, and season two has helped create a momentum that both audiences and networks can respect. A third season of a TV show, or even a second season, was unfamiliar territory for me. But I had been around long enough to know that season three was when actors renegotiated their contracts. The momentum of Burn Notice was undeniable, and the cast knew it was going to be around for a while. Renegotiating my contract was practically obligatory. Illicit Affairs. With tradition on my side, I brazenly approached the business affairs team through my trusty representatives and said, "Hey guys, this is a great show we're all making. Remember that moldy old contract we signed a few years ago? Hey, what do you say we just throw that silly thing away?" "Suck it," was essentially the reply. Business affairs, aka lawyers for studios and networks, are tough, ruthless negotiators who don't know the meaning of the word compromise. End-of-the-year bonuses are not calculated by compromise. In the midst of renegotiations, I ran into one of those cheery fellows at some unrelated event. Even out of the context of our deliberations, he was distant and resolute. "Bruce," he sneered, "I know it seems like I don't care about your problems. The truth is I don't even care about my wife's problems, so there's no way I'm going to care about yours." It's a little risky to ask a network or studio for a better deal when you've already agreed to a worse one. Characters get killed off all the time. Regardless, we approached the powers that be and asked for a better contract. When a show becomes a hit, there's a strong argument for the possibility that it's a hit because of the cast. Storylines and production values aside, the interaction of the characters and the chemistry established by the actors are undeniable factors when it comes to whether a show works or not. Writers, producers, and directors will all flip me the bird for saying this, but they can write their own memoirs and state their own cases. Actors don't typically make a percentage of profits. So if a show starts making more money, the only entities that benefit are the studios, networks, and other stakeholders. It may seem greedy, but when you're one of the forefront faces of the franchise, it's only natural to want a bigger piece of the pie when the pie starts getting bigger. That's why around season three, so many lead actors become producers, and so many supporting characters become dead. "What money?" barked the defensive line of negotiators. "You don't understand. We haven't gotten the foreign sales back yet. We're still hemorrhaging money. It's not in syndication. The license fee doesn't cover the production costs, and we haven't recouped the DVD money back yet because season one only just came out. So what are you looking for? You're looking for nothing." That's a pretty good lawyer imitation, by the way. Let's do some math. Burn Notice was made by 20th Century Fox for, let's say, X million dollars an episode. The USA Network pays a license fee of Y million dollars per episode, approximately half of what the show actually cost, to air it. and made its money back through advertising revenue. Fox still had to finance the remaining Z million out of its own pocket, hence the term deficit financing. Accounting-wise, until Fox made back more than X million dollars per episode from the remaining sources of income, foreign sales, syndication licensing, and DVDs, it was in the red, as each production is its own accountable entity. Therefore, tonally, Business Affairs took our request as something of an affront, a big ask at an inappropriate time. They reminded me, Bruce, you forgot that you signed something that you were perfectly happy with once. Your contract is for 7 years. After the obligatory pushback of their pushback, they agreed to give me a nominal raise. It wasn't what I hoped for, but I signed the updated agreement, thereby accepting their economic sob story at face value. Literally the next week, I was in London promoting My Name is Bruce, when the trade magazines reported that Jeffrey Donovan had successfully renegotiated his burn notice deal to earn more than twice his original contract. What the fuck? Now, I had no problem with Donovan. He deserved it. If I were him, I would have said, you're killing me with this workload. I'm the stem to stern star of this huge show. I do voiceover for the entire episode. I'm in almost every frame, every scene. Business Affairs knew fiscally that Michael Weston was the one character who couldn't be replaced. That part I understood. My beef was that instead of being straight up about it, they led me to believe that nobody was getting a raise. Kicking at the air in my London hotel room, I felt swindled and mentally prepared myself to walk away from burn notice. Dialing my lawyer's number, I paraphrased my complaint. This was an unwarranted decrease in comparative value. When we started burn notice, the rates for each role were X and Y, establishing, in my mind at least, a pay ratio. The new math threw everything out of whack. Sam's role in the series hadn't diminished. In fact, it had been increasing in screen time. Business Affairs may have been insulted that I asked for a raise at all, but I was offended that they saw such little relative value in me, and so emphatically. Normally, I have a pretty good handle on my temper, but this situation pushed my big red button. I don't want to play in their sandbox anymore, I screamed to my lawyer, Bill. Ask them to release me from my contract. I would like to go elsewhere with my services. To keep actors from leaping across corporate tables, we have representatives. They take our knee-jerk rants and physical threats and translate them into rational corporate speak for Business Affairs. The Fox response was not unexpected in the least. They stated formally, we are not releasing you from your contract. You have an obligation. That was rational corporate speak for don't fuck with us. The first day of shooting season 3 was fast approaching, and a standoff had created scuttlebutt among the key people of Burn Notice. The emails flew. Dude, you really going to bail? Are you serious? What's your plan? I explained to a few folks, Nix and Donovan included, that this wasn't about them. This was about the suits and my deal. Before it got officially ugly, with delayed shooting schedules and lawsuits served, Matt Nix offered a brilliant solution. Make a Sam Axe backstory TV movie and pay Bruce out of the Fox TV movie fund, not the burn notice account. I thought it was a great idea and agreed to do it. Nix was able to convince Fox to finance it, but the kicker was, as long as USA agreed to air it. The corporate versions of A Snake and a Mongoose had to come to their own terms on top of everything else. Eventually, they worked it out, and my contractual squabbles were over. It was a great solution, not only because it resolved the dispute, but it also gave me an opportunity to explore the depths of Sam Axe. Creating a spinoff based on your character is something an actor always hopes a TV show will do. Burn Notice started production up again for season 3 with a very happy Bruce Campbell. But 2 years would pass before production started on the untitled Sam Axe movie. My reps would gently remind Fox of their commitment. I thought we shut you up, they'd cry. When are we making the Sam Axe movie? Ah, I don't know, maybe next year. Go away. Then give us some money. We get paid whether you make the movie or not. All right, here, go away. Cut to 1 year later. What? You again? When are we making the Sam Axe movie? You tell that son of a bitch Campbell to go away. All right. Give us some more money. We got it coming. What? Oh, the audacity. We just go. Fox suddenly realized that they were paying me without making a movie. Giving money away and getting nothing in return is not part of the modern business school syllabus. All right. We'll make your damn movie. Columbia Pictures. It didn't make any sense. The story of the fall of Sam Axe was actually set in Columbia, so it couldn't possibly be filmed in Columbia, right? In my experience, you shot Michigan and Tennessee, Chicago and Portland, and Metropolis and Burbank. The shoot was set for Bogota, Colombia. All of it. Not just a few random exterior scenes where you sell the fact that you were really there. Bogota was not known for being a particularly hospitable city, so why spend the entire schedule there? The answer was pretty simple. Fox was owned by News Corp. In 2007, News Corp acquired a majority of Telecolombia, a full-service studio that mainly produced soap operas, affectionately known as telenovelas. Corporate mantra, use the resources you have. I met with Samuel, the managing president of the Colombian studio, and he showed me the research he did when his business became part of this multinational corporation. On the wall of his office was a hierarchy chart of News Corp. With all of its branching bronchioles and subsidiary connectors, it could have been an anatomical diagram of the lungs. Samuel pointed down to the lower right at Fox Telecolombia. Almost as far from the top as one could get, he understood his company's place on the international totem pole, and he had learned to accept it. In the general worldview, Colombia was widely known for its coffee, its cocaine, and its neckties. Bogota, as capital, had a reputation for being the Detroit of Colombia, a violent place where people got stabbed, shot, or kidnapped. Ironically, locals rarely talked about, or joked about, or used cocaine. The citizens of Bogota held great disdain for the drug because they equated it with all of their problems. Cocaine hurt them not only individually, but socially. The citizens wanted to end the drug wars, so they worked out an arrangement with the Fuerzas Armadas Revolucionarias de Colombia, known as FARC. Let's just go with that. FARC was essentially given a playground near the coast, and everyone else looked the other way. Colombia was shockingly close to Miami, only a 2-hour direct flight. Flying in, you could instantly see that a reputation for vice and violence wasn't the only thing choking Bogota. A thick, terrible smog hung over the city in a way that made the L.A. sky seem pristine. Beyond the typical urban pollution, the air was cursed by an abundance of traffic with no emission safeguards. Catalytic converters weren't installed as a rule, so even brand-new Colombian cars and trucks farted out exhaust in an endless standstill of gridlock. The city is nestled among the foothills in the Andes Mountains, and it was common for me to traverse from 8,300 to 11,000 feet in altitude for a day's work. The roads going over the mountains weren't just steep, they were narrow. Going uphill, I felt sorry for the cyclists navigating the gridlock. By felt sorry for, I mean that I was amazed these idiots thought turbo training during rush hour at exhaust pipe height was a good idea. Going back downhill after shooting, we appreciated that the smell of exhaust was at least replaced with a new one. Brake pads working overtime to stop lumbering vehicles from plunging off the mountain roads. Locked and loaded. Bogota, because of what was mostly in its past, had a thing about security. Personally, I've never seen things so locked down in my life. An armed man often stood in front of any packed restaurant, gun on full display. Policemen were on many random corners, and fully armed military troops stood atop numerous bridges and walkways. Ida and I only had a key to our actual apartment, not the outside door. We couldn't get in or out without the help of the lobby attendant. Ida was mildly claustrophobic and hated the idea that she was involuntarily sealed into the building. For the first time while on location, I was assigned a bodyguard. His name was Jose, and yes, he was packing heat. A real pro, he was clever enough to keep a distance as he shadowed me. Being seen as needing a bodyguard was just another way of saying you were, quote, probably worth kidnapping. Honestly, I didn't have a single problem while in Bogota, not even dirty looks from the locals. Other crew members who actually lived there weren't so fortunate. I put my foot in my mouth working with Malena, a young woman from the wardrobe department. She was doing her best to make my scarf look exactly the way the director wanted. You better get this right, Malena, I quipped.